Welcome to UW Medicine Town Hall. I'm Trish Critic, Vice Dean for Faculty Affairs. And with us today, we have John Lynch, Head of Infection Prevention and Employee Health at Harborview Medical Center, Tom Stager, Medical Director at UWMC, Anne Browning, Associate Dean for Wellbeing, Carrie Nazenbeni, new title, Chief Nursing Officer at Harborview Medical Center. Welcome in your new role. Cindy Sayer, Chief Nursing Officer at UWMC. Tim Dellett, Interim CEO and Dean of the School of Medicine, and Leslie Hampton, Interim Associate CNO at UWMC Northwest. And you might notice there's somebody I didn't introduce yet, and that's because we have a special guest today, and that's Dr. Kim Stone, who is the Associate Chief of Operations and the Clinical Director of the Emergency Department at Seattle Children's. And she's joining us today because, wow, there's a lot of kids with respiratory viruses and they're impacting.
Well, that's a first.
Well, this could be a major problem for town hall today.
She's right through the wall over there. So I'll go check on her and then she can come present from my office if needed. One second.
I think what Trish was trying to start to say is that we invited Kim Stone to join us here today because of the significant increase in RSV that we're seeing within our community and the impact certainly being seen at Seattle Children's. And so we received a number of questions regarding that. And so, again, we are really pleased to have Kim join us here to be able to share what's happening there and answer some of those questions that we received from all of you. Perhaps while Trish is trying to either rejoin or join Anne, maybe we can start with a well-being message.
Absolutely. I just checked in with Trish through the wall and her computer shut down magically during the start of town hall. So welcome everybody. Well-being message. We're about to run the gauntlet of another holiday season. And for many folks, this will be one that is spent around more people than it has been the last couple of years. I've been thinking about the holidays and in doing so, common themes that come up as general kind of excitement and stress. And often those two things happen in close to equal measure. So I've been thinking about why are the holidays stressful? I'm sure there are different reasons for all of us, but one idea I was thinking about this week is that when we come back together as a group, whether it's family or friends, we tend to revert to expecting each other there to show up as we were the last time we all hung out. But a lot of time has passed, and we have likely changed quite a bit, as have the folks we're likely to holiday with over the next couple months. So maybe we can give them and ourselves the gift of being curious about how folks have changed and give folks permission to grow and show up differently than they have. And maybe with that, some of the stress will be replaced with some positive energy of meeting folks in new ways and building some new rituals around, you know, how our holidays are shaped and what's to come. So whatever you're raising a glass to in the next couple months, a cheers from all of us at Town Hall, and may you find some very cool things in, you know, the people who you've known for a long time. With that, I see Trish's back, so I'll hand it to her, and then I will also see if she wants to come in and just present from my computer, if that's easier. Trish, how are you doing?
Yep. Trish, as we have seen throughout the pandemic, we are adapting and flexing. Now you just have to figure out how to unmute yourself.
Okay, I think I'm unmuted. And I think my computer is kind of working again, but not entirely. So I'm going to start from here and try to switch over. That is a first in all of these town halls. Kim, I'm not going to attribute it to you being here, but it was in the midst of me introducing you that the computer gods did something. So sorry, everybody. That was kind of crazy. And thank you so much for being so adaptable. Okay. I'm going to start off, and I'm actually going to start with John because it's easy and he's used to it. So let's start with you, and we'll go to Kim maybe relatively shortly after John. But John, can you talk about numbers of COVID for right now across UW Medicine?
Sure. COVID inpatients right now across UW Medicine, we're at 30 patients, which is up from the last time I spoke to you. We have 24 patients in acute care, six are in the ICU. UWMC's got six folks in acute care, one in the ICU, Northwest campus has 7 in acute care, 1 in the ICU. Valley is at 7 as well on acute care, 1 in the ICU. And Harborview has 4 people on acute care, 3 in the ICU. And one of those acute care patients is in our behavioral health unit.
So a little bit up from where we've been, but not dramatically different. Two questions. One is, are we sequencing viruses in our labs? And so do we know what kind of variants we're seeing of the folks that are getting admitted to the hospital or maybe even just in the community?
Yeah, so we don't do sequencing of our patients who are in the hospital, but we our UW laboratory medicine team is actually global leaders in this area and do a huge amount of sequencing and contribute not only to looking at what's going on here, but nationally, internationally. And so we do have data on that. I think most of this data, probably most up to date, is at the national level through the CDC variant tracking dashboard. And so, yeah, we do have a lot of good information on what's going on out there. And that's impacting lots of really important decisions we're making around things like therapeutics and other decisions.
Do we have a sense of what variants we're seeing in the area?
Yep. So if we look at that dashboard, so just to, again, sort of ground people in these terms, everything I'm talking about are Omicron variants this whole year. So the January surge was BA1. This summer surge was BA5. And what we're seeing right now is BA5 is being pushed aside as more infectious, more transmissible variants emerge. And this has been the same story throughout. And the variants we're seeing now, so BA5 is probably down around 30% of all the variants. This is sort of a rough estimate because of the time delay and so forth. Mm-hmm. But around 30% of everything out there is this BA5, which we've dealt with all summer. And what's really emerging are 2 other variants, BQ1 and BQ1.1, which are both around 20-ish percent. And then there's another one called BF7, which is around 10%. So what we're going to be seeing is this BQ1 and BQ1.1 as the predominant variants. But I want to be cautious here when I say that, and that there's actually a whole bunch of variants at much lower percentages. And it really feels like we're in a different phase where we're really what people are kind of calling the alphabet soup variant phase of this, where we have lots of different variants with a few really standing out. And we're going to have to see how they battle it out and which ones will emerge in the coming months.
Okay. So as opposed to before when we saw like 1 Delta, woo, everyone was getting Delta. Now we're seeing a bunch of different variants of Omicron.
Yep.
Appreciated. Relevant to kind of all the different soup, one of the questions we got was about reinfection and, mm-hmm. and what is the risk of being reinfected as we see different ones? I think there were folks who sent in questions and actually sent links to papers. Okay. I sent you the link to one of them. So maybe you could speak to the risks associated with reinfection.
Yeah, so this is actually a pretty difficult and challenging question to answer because it depends on lots of things, as it often does in medicine and epidemiology. It depends upon what variants you're exposed to. It depends upon what your vaccination status is. It depends upon whether you've been infected before and with which variant, right? So I think that the take home here and what we understand at this point is that being boosted protects you from infection at some level. You know, not as good as it did way back when, but still at a reasonable level, and definitely helps prevent serious COVID disease, so yep. hospitalization and death. The issue about reinfection is hard to sort of take apart. And I think what that paper that you sent to me was a study in the VA administration data looking mm-hmm. at almost 6 million people and looking at reinfection. And I think the take home here is a little bit challenging, but what a lot of people read it as is that getting subsequent reinfections is like additively worse. And I think that's not what is the take-home message. It's the take-home message is that if you get infected, there's a whole host of things that can happen to you. You can have mild infection, asymptomatic infection. You can have serious infection. In some proportions, we will go on to develop long COVID symptoms, right, that persist after infection. And the issue is that what that paper showed us is that there are people who get reinfected and all those things can happen again.
Yep.
And so being reinfected is worse than not getting reinfected. And we know that vaccination interrupts reinfection or infection to begin with. So it isn't so much that getting a second infection is worse than the first one. It's just that getting COVID twice is worse than getting it once. And once is way worse than getting it not at all, right?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
I think so. So I think the big take homes are 1, as you said, Boosters help, you can get infected with after you're boosted, but it helps you from getting sick with infection. And every time you get infected, you can either have no symptoms, mild symptoms, or severe symptoms. So if you get infected multiple times, that risk of those different outcomes is there each of those times.
Right.
Okay. Thank you. I think that was actually very clear. So thank you for going through that.
Thank goodness.
I do have one other follow-up for you. And that is, how about boosting and long COVID? Because I think a lot of the things that people are worrying about now is, you know, it seems like you don't get quite as sick if you've been boosted.
Yep.
But what about long COVID?
Yeah. So this is another really challenging area. So I think the bottom line up front here is that a lot of people who get infected get long COVID. The issue is we haven't firmed up what the definition of long COVID is. So that's one challenge here, exactly what it is. And there's no lab test for it, right? So we still have to figure out what we're calling it. But a lot of people having long-term symptoms, well past, weeks past their acute infection. It's happening a lot more than we ever would have guessed. And we know that not getting infected means you're not going to get long COVID. So being vaccinated, boosted, protecting you from infection, protecting you from severe disease is going to protect you from long COVID. So there are data now that even with breakthrough infections in people with COVID, so you're vaccinated, you get a breakthrough infection compared to people who are not vaccinated. There is now a few papers out there. And again, we need a bit more data, but our signaling is a good signal that being vaccinated and having a breakthrough infection has a lower risk of long COVID.
Okay. I think
that's a really good take home, I think.
Yeah, I think that is the take home. And yes, we will continue to gather data, but in general, the data suggest if you're vaccinated and boosted, you know, fully vaccinated and boosted, that you are less likely to get long COVID.
Right.
Okay. That's great. Last question for you before I pivot to Kim for a few is, and I meant to ask this last week and last time I forgot that the King County COVID dashboard has reflected that there's higher rates of cases, hospitalizations, and deaths among folks who are boosted.
Yeah.
And people are like, is that right?
So it's, again, it's
complicated.
I love you throwing all these questions to me. So here again, bottom line up front, that if you look at the populations of folks who end up in the hospital and the folks who end up dying, right, they're not the same as everyone else. If you look in King County, the people who end up in the hospital and the people who end up dying are people with risks. So people, and you know, in one of the biggest risks is age. So people as they get older are at higher risk. And you look at the populations who are vaccinated and or boosted, and right, those aren't separate. So people with higher risk, people at older age groups in our area, this isn't true everywhere to be clear, are more likely to be vaccinated and boosted. And so when you have a lot of people who are boosted, you know, more numbers are going to end up in the hospital. But the take home here, and this is the really important point, is that if you look at the rate, you take that number and you put it over the total denominator, being boosted or being fully vaccinated is highly protective for those groups. So if you look at just hospitalizations, the one you asked about, the rate of hospitalizations among boosted individuals is 0.17 per 100,000. The fully vaccinated, 0.13 per 100,000, which are basically the same. And if you're not fully vaccinated for that same for hospitalization, it's 1.3 per 100,000.
Okay.
So being fully vaccinated, being boosted is highly protective against being hospitalized. Okay. And it's the same thing for people who are dying from COVID, highly protective.
So the reason that we see, first of all, the rates are higher for hospitalizations and for death for people who are not fully vaccinated.
Correct.
And we see higher numbers of people who are boosted in these hospitalizations and deaths because so many of the people around us are already boosted. That's the majority of the people around us. So right. I appreciate you clarifying that. And I did give you a bunch of hard questions to start with. So thank you for doing that. And I'm going to pivot to Kim and start easy so that.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Because I'm really grateful for you for you joining us. And I'll just say now, and I'll say it again, and grateful for your leadership in a time of a lot of stress in the emergency department and throughout Seattle Children's. So can you tell us about the numbers, like John, I just asked about COVID, but in general, the numbers that you're seeing in the ED and being admitted to Seattle Children's with, you know, RSV and other respiratory viruses?
Yeah, so probably you've been hearing a lot through news media, through our own internal channels about the skyrocketing rates. We are seeing unprecedented volumes coming into the emergency department. So just for comparison, the best year for us to compare to was 2019, just given all of the weirdness with COVID and pediatrics as it originally started. And on average, we would see in Seattle Children's Emergency Department about 130 to 140 kids per day. That's new arrivals coming into our emergency department every day. A busy day was about 150. So peak winter volumes were somewhere in the neighborhood of 150. You might get up to 160, 170 was really, 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 really busy. We are so far beyond that now. Our busiest day ever was during H1N1 several years ago, and we peaked at 250 patients at that time. We now, and it's climbing each week, we now are routinely seeing somewhere in the neighborhood of 250 patients per day, new arrivals showing up in the emergency department. We just last week, the average was more like 230. We're going up each week, and we peaked just under 300. We're going to cross the 300 threshold sometime here fairly soon at about 293 new arrivals per day. Our census, so how many patients we'll take care of in that total 24-hour period, because that includes the midnight to midnight time, is well over 300 patients in a 24-hour
period. So that's nearly double.
Exactly. I was going to say we've nearly doubled our new arrivals daily. And they're continuing to rise.
And I know that your main focus is the folks who are coming in the ED. Can you reflect on what the admissions or like the census is like?
Yeah, the hospital census also has been climbing. I mean, I think the highest census that I've heard from us is somewhere in the neighborhood of 330 for the hospital census. So the hospital has been opening new spaces, refurbishing old spaces, and you know, repurposing spaces as fast as they possibly can. And so the hospital capacity is running over 100%. Or, you know, we're adding new rooms so that we're not hitting quite 100%, but really over 100% daily. Yeah. A lot of this right now is RSV. Our rates of RSV are skyrocketing somewhere about 40 to 50-ish percent, I'm trying to remember numbers off the top of my head, of all of our lab tests that were done for the entire hospital over the last couple of weeks have been positive for RSV. I can tell you that at any given time, you look at the census in the ED, about 50% of them are there for pure respiratory illness.
Okay, so this huge doubling is really driven by respiratory illness, and it sounds like the majority of it is RSV. And one of the questions that came in from a lot of people is, and we've kind of touched on this, but why do you think we're having such high numbers right now?
Yeah, so, you know, we've had during COVID, we've had little bits of RSV peaks. We usually peak more like January, February in that time frame. So I think I will look to sort of the infectious disease and immunology people that might know better. I think what we're seeing really is the fact that kids haven't gotten sick as much over the last 2 to 3 years. And so it's just like John was saying in terms of a new infection, right? Like their immune systems haven't seen this. They haven't had a chance to develop any immunity from this. Most kids usually will have had RSV infection by the time they're about 2 to 3 years old. That's a typical viral illness that a young child will have. And so you have children that were born during the pandemic and have gone through the pandemic and really never seen this virus, as well as some of the other common ones. We're talking a lot about RSV, but we're seeing flu rise. I'm sure you guys are as well. We were hit just very recently. It's kind of a little bit on a downtrend now, but enterovirus D68, which caused a lot of respiratory symptoms in kids. So there's a lot circulating right now. And we just haven't had much illness in kids over the last 2 to 3 years. So now masks are off, kids are in school, and they're transmitting, and it's kind of spreading. I think about it as if anybody's had a kid that the very first time they put them in daycare and they keep getting viral illness after viral illness, or the first time they go to kindergarten. You know, we often get a slew of families that come in at the end of September, the first time that they go to kindergarten, and they're like, they've been sick for a month, right? And they just get repeated viral illnesses. This is what's happening, but on this giant scale, because everybody's been a little bit naive to illnesses over these last 2 to 3 months.
Yeah, so people haven't been exposed and now everybody's getting sick. And some of those folks are getting sick enough to be in the hospital. In a former life, I was a first grade teacher's aide for a year and I lived that experience. I got every bug there was known to man. And so I can completely relate to that. So you said that most folks are coming, a lot of the tests are positive for RSV. Are you using rapid testing for RSV and rapid testing for COVID and influenza all at the same time? How does that work?
Yeah, the platform that we use is a combined rapid COVID, flu, and RSV. We have started, so that is our rapid. We don't do just a rapid COVID or just a rapid
RSV. You do them all together.
We have the three. But because space is at a premium, we're actually cohorting admissions as well. So we actually are doing, as a baseline, another rapid platform that actually includes some of the other common illnesses. So parainfluenza, the influenza, all of the influenza viruses, coronavirus, rhinovirus, enterovirus. So that way we can cohort patients and families to preserve space. So we're kind of capturing a lot, especially for our admitted population, we're capturing a lot of the viruses that are out there right now. And they're all there. I'll tell you, they're all there.
So you're doing rapid testing for RSV, COVID, and influenza, plus a broader spectrum of viruses. Because when you say cohort, what that means is patients and their families being in similar spaces or in group spaces for care because things are so tight. And I'll just...
Because some of our rooms are double rooms, you want to have patients and families rooming with like viruses so that they're not going to catch something else.
Yeah.
So if we need to use double rooms, which we do.
Okay. Trish, can I just add one quick thing?
Because this is please, a
really good demonstration of how the vaccines are working around COVID. Because these kids aren't coming in with COVID, yet they are getting other respiratory viruses. And I think this is a real world example of the power of the vaccines in these pediatric, this smaller population. So I think it's just real world experience.
I appreciate you saying that. Thank you, John. And I think that is a really good point that what you said, Kim, maybe some COVID, but that's very tiny compared to how much RSV you're seeing.
Yeah, we have a small R's. I didn't grab our numbers from today before I got on this call, but we've been in the single digits for patients with COVID. And it's, for the most part, for pediatrics, it's not primary COVID disease. It's they have a co-infection. They're being admitted for another reason and they happen to have COVID.
Yeah, are also COVID positive, but or SARS-CoV-2 positive. Okay, I'm gonna ask you one more question now. I may come back as we kind of pivot around. And this one's a little bit philosophical. So I usually tell John he can't wax on too long. I'm gonna give you a little latitude on this one. And that is, can you speak to the impacts of lots of kids with viral infections? Like, obviously there's the impact on that individual child who's sick, and particularly if they have to be admitted to the hospital, that's a big deal. But what are the downstream effects of a kid being sick?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're all feeling already the staff shortages, right? But across the board, I'm trying to remember, right after school got back into session, we had a couple of days where our nursing staff and other groups, they had a giant number of call-outs. And we actually did a little bit of an investigation and figured out that for the majority of the staff that were calling out, they had a kid sick at home. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't come to work. And so you have teachers who are, of course, being infected, just like as you said, when you were a teacher's assistant, Trish, as well as healthcare staff as well, who are not being able to come to work. And that just sort of has a ripple effect through everything. And also, everybody's testing for COVID and paying attention to symptoms. But of course, as we all know, kids are infected and back in school and what have you before they might have symptoms and all of this. So the transmission is happening very rapidly. You're seeing kids and whole classes that are coming in and saying that, oh yeah, I got to notice, you know, somebody in my class or someone in my daycare, whatever, has RSV. And so it's rapidly transmitting. And then you're seeing all the effects of having a system that needs parents to stay home to take care of them.
I appreciate you speaking to the impact on the many parents who are parts of our system as well. Absolutely. Okay, I'm going to ask you, Anne's harassed me to ask you two rapid fire questions. These are rapid fire now, though.
Rapid fire. Okay.
The first one is there a risk of RSV reinfection? And if so, how much of a risk is that?
You know, it's not as high. So common cold, you get reinfected frequently with. There is some immunity built up. So John can sort of chime in probably a little bit more. I never say never, but it's not a frequent thing that you see.
Okay. And if you have more to say about that, John, I'll come back to you in a little bit. But the other real quick question, Kim, is what are the age groups that you're seeing most commonly? Yeah.
This is a great question because this is different this year. So the vast majority of years, RSV affects 2 and under most significantly. The younger you are, the sicker you tend to be, and some complications. But because we have older kids, school age kids, 4 to 8, that may never have really encountered this because of the pandemic, this is a whole new population of kids that we're actually seeing with RSV type illnesses. And I hear actually from my adult colleagues that they're seeing adults also getting RSV and getting sicker and having sort of more respiratory viral illness, lower respiratory viral illness as a result of RSV than in past years.
Okay, that's super helpful. So usually we think of RSV being kids who get really sick, the littlest kids, and now we're seeing a broader array. And John, I'll just follow up with you. Thank you, Kim, so much.
Yeah, of course, thanks.
I will follow up with you with just one question real quickly that Kim just prompted, which is, are we seeing RSV and influenza in our adult populations now?
Yeah, so we're definitely seeing influenza. Just a quick snapshot is earlier this week, I think we had 6 people hospitalized with influenza at the Montland campus, at least 1 at Northwest.
Okay.
3 or 4 at Harborview. So severe enough to be hospitalized, definitely seen in the outpatient setting. RSV, we haven't seen them inpatient as much for the reasons that Dr. Stone mentioned. But when these tests are done, we have the same sort of tests where we do flu, RSV, and COVID. Mm-hmm. We actually have, because we're, you know, biased away from kids in UW Medicine to some extent.
Yeah.
We're
not biased against kids, but
no,
yeah.
No, not biased.
Just wanted to clarify COVID. That.
Our testing is adult-centric, and so we are actually seeing more positive adults.
Oh, interesting.
In the hundreds with RSV, since this respiratory virus season started. Actually, way more than even kids, despite seeing both. And historically, like Kim said, that was a kid. It was really a kid infection, and now we're seeing it a lot of it in adults.
That's interesting. So more RSV in adults, starting to see flu in adults, and even some patients admitted with flu. So things, I'm going on service in the MICU on Monday, so things that I'm paying attention to particularly. All right. Thank you, John. I'm going to come back to you and Kim in a bit, probably. Tim, I'm going to come over to you. And, I asked him that question about kind of the impact on folks, because I think we got a series of questions about kind of still feeling the impact of the pandemic. And maybe it's feeling the impact of other things too, like RSV and whatnot. And one specific question we got was whether there was any chance that the UW COVID Emergency Fund could be revived? Because I think people are feeling the financial pressures still as well.
Yeah, just a couple of comments. And again, there's information available on the university website as well. So with the end of the state of emergency by Governor Inslee on October 31st, there was a message that was sent out for kind of those last applications for the emergency funds to be submitted by October 14th. Now, that's from the university perspective. We do have some residual emergency funds within UW-Medicine that we received from donors, and we are looking at how can we use those funds, particularly to support well-being efforts for our community, our faculty, staff, trainees. I don't think there's going to be an extension of emergency funds just because of where we are in this phase and hopefully emerging from the pandemic, recognizing it is still really challenging from a financial perspective, particularly for many of our employees, given the inflationary pressures. But I think we're just trying to figure out, okay, the formal process is done through the university. How can we best utilize those residual funds to best support our people?
Okay, I appreciate that. So that fund ended when the emergency from the governor ended. And so that's closed. And there are some other funds that we'll be thinking about how we will continue to support our community with a focus on the well-being of our community, which I very much appreciate. You know, we appreciate hearing about what's happening at Seattle Children's, and our faculty, many of our faculty from UW School of Medicine are our faculty at Seattle Children's. How does UW Medicine, you know, check in with what's going on at Seattle Children's?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I mean, certainly on the medical staff leadership, there's communication so that we have a sense of what is happening. And we've done that throughout the pandemic. We would have communication with the leadership at Seattle Children's. Our infection prevention teams are constantly in communication around what everyone is seeing. I think one of the challenges is that Seattle Children's is really challenged from a capacity standpoint. Our other hospitals within UW Medicine, even though we may not be seeing as much RSV, we're still continuing to be challenged and over 100% capacity as well. And so this is one of our concerns, and we knew this going into the respiratory season, that our hospitals across the state are at capacity. And so there's just not that wiggle room in the healthcare system in general within the state in terms of where do we flex to try to help one another when all the hospitals are facing similar capacity and staffing challenges, even if they're slightly different causes.
I appreciate that. Like ongoing communication, we try to keep that communication open, and finding a bed anywhere around right now is so hard, whether it's at Seattle Children's or at any of the other hospitals that we talk about as part of UW Medicine. Thank you. I'm going to ask you, we actually didn't get many questions about Mission Forward, but I did get one that I wanted to follow up with you on, and that was a question about what is the connection or lack thereof between Mission Forward and FIT? That was an initiative that we had earlier. Is that ongoing? Are they connected? Could you clarify that?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. You know, FIT was based on kind of financial transformation pre 2019. I think it started back in 2017 when we also faced some significant financial challenges, through the pandemic again, and then coming out here with Mission Forward. I would see these as not necessarily an extension of FIT, because there's there are some shared similarities in terms of how do we ultimately sustain our ability to really advance our mission. Mm-hmm. To serve our communities and do that in a fiscally responsible manner. But they're really, I would say, FIT as sunset. But those principles, some of those principles are still important within Mission Forward. When we think of supply chain as an example, right? How do we, where it makes sense, you know, standardize our processes, become more efficient in the care that we deliver? How do we try to decrease cost where possible, while also really looking at those growth opportunities from a revenue improvement? And so it's not one and the same, but there's some shared principles. And I would consider FIT sunset at this point and focus on the Mission Forward work.
Okay, so FIT has sunset, focused on Mission Forward, some similar principles. And we'll talk more about Mission Forward as we get more questions about it, but I thought that was a good thing just to clarify. Okay, I'm going to keep popcorning around, so you're off the hook for a little bit, but I have more for you because I have more on the list there. I'm going to follow up with Tom because Tim just commented on the census, and we got some questions about the census. And so the simple question that came in a couple times is, has our census at Harborview or UWMC improved at all?
I can comment on the UWMC census, and we are continuing to operate at high levels of census and higher levels of census than we did last year. And I expect that to continue for the foreseeable future for at least a couple of reasons. One is the number of patients with complex illnesses that would benefit from our unique services seems to be, if anything, growing. Second is, as Tim alluded to, there's a great number of other facilities that are having challenges fully staffing their beds. And we know, at least anecdotally, that there are some facilities that aren't utilizing all of their beds because of staffing challenges. And that leads to those facilities, when they've got, you know, very complex patients, reaching out to us that much more often. So we are continuing to operate at very high levels, and that is going to continue for, you know, quite some time.
Yeah. So I think this is kind of what we're thinking we're going to have to keep working with. And for the reasons you just described, and I think also continue to think of ways to try to mitigate it. So is there anything new that we're working on to try to mitigate the pressure of that census?
Yeah, I think we are, you know, making some progress. We are continuing to identify and implement best practices in terms of the throughput of our patients, to try and standardize and use our capacity as well as possible, figure out how to overcome barriers to get patients out, when, you know, figuring out how can we provide procedures in a timely manner when that might be holding up their progression. And some meetings have occurred just this week around that question. Other things we've done, and it really just started this week, is a huddle around high census. So when our ED gets to a certain level of capacity at either of our campuses, a group comes together to figure out what can we do, where can we board patients, how can we identify, you know, capacity that we can utilize, so that I think we're doing a better job, partly because we're getting more practice at it, in figuring out what do we do when we get to these really high levels of census, and how can we manage in a way to have the least negative impact on our patients as well as on our staff who's working at taking care of these patients.
Yeah, I appreciate that. So some of them are long-term strategies to try to, you know, expedite throughput, making sure people get the things they need to get while they're in the hospital as quickly as we can do it safely. And also these kind of real-time coming together to try to strategize. I appreciate that this is going to be an ongoing challenge. And I also appreciate the ongoing work to come up with new strategies to try to mitigate some of this. I'll ask you one more question. We had a couple of people who were curious about how we're doing with vaccinations amongst our medical staff. And then I'm going to ask our nursing leaders the same about our staff.
Sure. The data I got just this morning for UWMC across both our campuses shows that 82% of our medical staff, we have a record of them receiving their flu shot and their COVID bivalent booster.
Okay.
That's an underestimate of the actual numbers. There's some data entry time lag. There's people who have gotten their vaccines who haven't responded to the emails. There's a little bit of list cleanup of people who no longer work here that will winnow out. So, you know, it's north of 82%, and we're working on getting it up to 100%.
Okay, so we're at 82%. And Cindy, maybe I'll turn to you next. Where do we stand with staff at UWMC?
Yep, so we have 82% of our staff current on their flu vaccine and 75% on the COVID booster. And I think to Tom's point, there's also been a data entry, this data entry lag, right? So there people can be getting these vaccines outside of our system, and it's taking, as you can imagine, our employee health team time to catch up. So
okay.
I think we actually are doing better than those numbers.
So 82 for flu, 75% for COVID booster. We think we're lagging on actually knowing that truth. I think, does that cover both campuses? Your number? Okay.
Yes.
Carrie, how about at Harborview?
Harborview's also at 82%. That's the magical number today for flu. We still have some work to do with COVID, though I agree with Cindy and Tom that this is an underestimate. We're only at a 50% compliance with the COVID booster here at Harborview. So definitely have some work to do in that space, and are actively working with our teams to get that number.
Okay. So 50% right now with the COVID bivalent booster, and some work to do there. And 82% is the number on flu vaccines right now, evidently. Okay. We'll come back to that another town hall. I got this question, and these are the kinds of ones I love. Can we open up the water fountains in our hospitals and clinics again? And so I'm going to ask each of you, Leslie, are the water fountains open at Northwest?
No, and we don't really have plans to open them at this moment. I think if we could like have a wave of magic wand, we'd have those water bottle fillers replacing all of the water fountains, but no plans right now.
No plans right now. Cindy, is the same true at Montlake?
Same for now.
Okay. Carrie, Harborview?
The water fountains at Harborview have been open since May of 2021. I don't have any of that context, but I think John does. And Vanessa said that Vanessa McCarowitz, who's our infection prevention manager and nursing guru here, said that we felt like it was safe and just needed to flush those tongues before obviously reusing those. So,
okay, so sounds like John agrees with that. And so it sounds like we have a disparate water fountain practices. I'm going to guess this person works either on the Northwest campus or at Montlake. And I guess I would challenge us to think about whether or not there's opportunity there. I'm not sure. Water is important. Safety is important. Both are important, but differences in practice. And so more to come. The other question I have for the three of you, and I'll look to you, Cindy. You know, we've talked about a lot of work to recruit and efforts to bargain and have our incentives to hire people or to keep people. And one of the questions we got is, what are we doing to incentivize our non-union employees and staff? And so maybe you could talk to that a little bit, and then I'll let Leslie and Carrie add to it.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think it is really important, and we've learned this lesson, that the salaries that we offer need to be competitive in the community so that we can attract and retain the best healthcare team. So that's without a doubt. We had almost every one of our contracts was bargained in the month of September, and our compensation team did incredible work to run through each of those contracts working tirelessly.
Yes.
They are, yeah. And then there's a group of people that weren't covered, and we're aware of that, whether it's pro staff or classified non-union. And so they're looking at those positions now, but it takes them time to do all of that data, to gather all of the data, look at the community comps, and decide, you know, how UW Medicine is going to proceed. I don't know, Carrie, if you would say it differently.
Yeah, I think, I guess the only thing I would add is that I wish we had more information to share. Unfortunately, we just don't have anything quite yet, but certainly we have that information. I think this is a top priority for all of us, right, is ensuring that our wages are competitive and that we're keeping our staff and able to recruit new ones. So,
okay. So what I heard was a lot of focus on all of the bargaining that we needed to do, and it was a priority, and that's a lot of time and energy, and we're already shifting our focus to looking at the folks who weren't part of that negotiation. And that's an ongoing series of efforts to make sure that we're being as competitive as we can be for all of the employees that we have. Does that sound about right? Okay. Leslie, I didn't give you a chance to add. Is there anything you wanted to add? You're good. Okay. Thank you so much. All right. Now it's time to go back and ask some more questions. John, I'm going to turn to you for a minute. Had a bunch of questions about masks. So, N95s and aerosol generating procedures. So I think we've said many times that you need to wear an N95 if you're doing an aerosol generating procedure or you're in the room, but how about in the spaces around where those are happening?
It depends upon the spaces and like how people move around those things. So for example, at the Harborview PACU, there are AGPs done in that space. It's basically like a lot of PACUs, essentially one very large room. And so our requirement is that everyone wears an N95 in that larger space, because there's no way to constrain where the AGP is happening. Now, you can definitely make an argument that say, you know, as you distance away, the risk drops dramatically because of air handling, ventilation, filtration, and so forth. But with something like a PACU, everyone's moving around, right? And so it doesn't really work well. So we've looked at each of those spaces and try to make it fit not only the risk to healthcare workers, other patients, but also the space and how people move. And so that would be the take home.
Okay. So in general, if you can compartmentalize it, then it can be in that compartmentalized space. But if it's a big open space, we're saying everybody in that area needs to wear an N95.
Yep.
And I think we've talked about this before, but one person asked, where can I find the most recent masking guidelines? So I'm going to start with that question.
Yeah. So all of our intranet sites have, you know, a COVID-19 button on the front, or you go to the infection prevention and control site on the internet, and there's a COVID-19 button there, and our masking policies are available there. They're all kept up to date, and they're consistent across UW Medicine.
Intranet COVID-19 button, that's where you can find them. Yep. Thank you. And right now, a question that we get every single town hall is, are we thinking about stepping down the requirements on masks?
You know, like Tim said earlier, you know, we look at all this data every single day and think about all of these questions every single day. Again, bottom line up front that you like Trish, no, we're not changing any of our masking requirements. And it has to do with a bunch of things. One is the COVID rate out there remains, the transmission level remains high, right? So there's a lot of COVID still going on. We have patients who come in who don't appear to have any symptoms and they're found subsequently have COVID. I do not want any employees getting COVID in the course of their work. We aerosol generating procedures can happen on people with no symptoms who have no previous testing and can have COVID. And then we don't, that could create a higher risk there. So at the moment, we want to keep that in place. In addition, for all the things that Kim talked about, there is a lot of RSV out there. There's a lot of enterovirus out there, and there's an increasing amount of influenza, right? And masks stop transmission of all of those things when we wear them universally in healthcare settings. So it's even, it feels like it's even better reason for universal protection and source control with masks right now.
I appreciate that. I was just going to emphasize that too.
I mean, I think many of us think this is going to be a really challenging respiratory virus season. We're seeing this already, you know, not only the magnitude of cases, but early, as Kim was mentioning at Seattle Children's, and whether that's going to go up and hopefully plateau, but will it sustain over a prolonged period of time? We just don't know. And even if we don't see as much COVID-19 coming in, I fully expect we're going to see more influenza. We're going to see more of these other respiratory viruses. So I think changing and going away from universal masking at this stage, as we go into this respiratory virus season further, just doesn't make a lot of sense. And I think we're going to, I would think, and again, it's up to John and Seth and all of the team, but it's probably going to be a reassessment once we get to the other side later in winter, spring. Quite frankly, just being realistic in terms of what we're seeing now.
I think it's good to set expectations that we think it's going to kind of hold steady the way it is. I will ask one follow-up question to that, John, because it's the question that is always a follow-up question. Sure. The distinction between universal masking and wearing N95s. And I think that the current guideline is the highest level of protection that you can continue to wear while you're doing your work. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay, so some people are going to be wearing a surgical mask because that's what they can tolerate. And we're hoping that if you can wear an N95, you wear an N95.
That's right.
Okay.
Yep, you got it.
Okay. You've only told it to me 20 times, so I finally got it. So, whew, good. One question for you, and then I'm going to go back to Kim for a quick one and Tim for a quick one, and then hand it over to Ann. High-dose flu vaccine, who should get it?
Oh, you asked me this question, and I forgot to look it up. I haven't asked this question for a while, but it's, I think, Tim, what is it? It's over 50.
I love how he just said, asked you, Tim, so that you can also say you don't know.
Tim forgets he's an ID doctor, too. He's an ID doctor, Tim.
Okay, someone's going to put it in the chat, and we'll say it out loud. It's good. Yeah,
it's people my age or older, I think.
So. That's a great guideline. Everyone older than John, get a high dose.
Everyone who's indicated should get the high dose. It is.
Yeah. We'll clarify that one.
I totally spaced on that. Sorry, guys.
That's okay. No worries. It's all good. Kim, I kind of think we've answered this, but I feel like I want to ask it to you because it came in a couple different times. And that is, people are like, well, since kids haven't been exposed and now they're getting infected, should we just get them exposed? Like, should I have my kid go play with other kids and not worry about it and not wear a mask?
Well, I think this is a complicated question, right? And I think the answer to that really is unique to each child and each family, right? I mean, there is a burden of disease that is borne by the child and by the family. And you can't predict that your kid's gonna have a mild form or a more severe form. So the idea of like the chickenpox parties or what have you, as well as then the transmission. So there's a balance between wanting to have kids interact and have that social interaction and be part of a family and do family things. Thanksgiving's coming up, being part of the gatherings and things like that. But that whole like, hey, let's go get everybody and just like, let's get it over with, right? I mean, that's a huge burden of societal disease. And then you can't predict what your kid's gonna do, right? With any of these. And then if you don't know what you know, what that impact is going to be like on you and your family as well. So I'm fully in support of families getting together, but we've learned through the pandemic how you can safely mitigate these things, right? If you're feeling sick, then stay home, because yes, we can test for COVID, but we don't have as universally widely available tests for RSV, flu, and all of the other things that are out there as well.
So masking, if you're sick, stay home. Probably don't have an RSV party. And it's that risk benefit kind of you need your kids to be with other kids and socialize. And we also don't know what's going to happen if you get infected. So some caution. I appreciate that. It's nuanced. And I appreciate you kind of talking it through. Okay, Tim, I'm going to squeeze one more in for you because I forgot it last time and it's totally different. And I invited all kinds of questions. So what is the strategic goal for continued partnership across WAMI? And the person asked that question in light of the fact that it's the 50th anniversary of WAMI.
Well, that's a long question. But, you know, WAMI was created about 50 years ago, first in Alaska, then Montana, Idaho, and then in the 90s, Wyoming was added. It was built on partnership with local organizations. And with that in mind, I actually just want to acknowledge the real tragedy that we're seeing in Moscow, Idaho, and the death of the four students at the University of Idaho, which is our partner there. And so those relationships, whether it be University of Alaska, University of Idaho, Montana State, you know, University of Wyoming, those partners are critical, right? As are all of the volunteer faculty that we have throughout the WAMI region that help provide supervision and training and education for our students. So we can't do this alone. WAMI is built on partnerships with the local institutions. We have shared faculty, particularly in the foundation phases. And then we really rely on the local practitioners and local healthcare systems to help train our students. And then we also have residents within WAMI in the same manner. And so the partnerships are critical. Now, I do think WAMI will continue to evolve over the next 50 years, but it has to be built on partnerships with the local organizations and people.
I first of all, great job on a short answer on a whole huge topic. And I really appreciate you calling out what's been extremely traumatic for folks in Idaho and including many of our students. And so thank you for acknowledging that. And been a scary and distressing time. Okay, Anne, I'm going to hand it over to you. I think it's still Tim. So Tim, I think you can keep yourself unmuted for Ask an ID Doc.
Yeah, thank you, Trish. Okay, so we had a couple questions come in around Ask a Friendly Infectious Disease Doc, really around holidays and then kind of learning to live with COVID-19. And in that kind of learning to live with COVID-19 section, it really came down to this idea that, you know, we've been recommending masking and ways to kind of mitigate transmission, but people are seeing fewer and fewer folks masking up on planes and conferences and galas. And so it's creating a bit of a stressful scenario for folks to try and figure out what should they be doing versus kind of what is humanity in their local area doing right now. So I'm curious, how are you kind of navigating the nuances of masking? When do you decide when to mask and when to not to right now?
You know, that's a great question. And it's easy at work within our hospitals and clinics where you know that you're going to be wearing a mask. And I still wear a mask when I come into work, when I meet with people, even in my office using a mask. I think outside of the work environment, it's really that risk balance, right? You've got to think about, okay, as an individual, what are my risks for more severe disease? Who are the individuals that I may be around? And I have to say, you know, my mindset has shifted a little bit, in part because with COVID-19, when you look within our region at the relatively high rates of vaccination, boosters, as well as if people haven't been vaccinated and boosted, then they may have had natural infection. So we have pretty good baseline immunity. And so we're seeing a little bit less severe disease around here. I wear a mask when I go to the grocery store, right? I wear a mask when I go to most stores. I will say back in mid-February or mid-October, there was a gala that I attended, and I did not wear a mask there. Now, I did look at what were our local rates of transmission at that time as part of that, but it was a judgment call, right, in terms of what did I feel comfortable doing there. And so there are some environments where I haven't worn a mask as much as perhaps I would have a year ago. Now, where we are, though, a month later with the respiratory viruses going up, if I were going to that same gala, I would wear a mask, right? So there's a little bit of a difference of what's happening within the environment. I can say when I go to the airport, I still wear a mask. When I'm on the plane, I still wear a mask. And I probably am not going to change that for quite some time. But I fully acknowledge there are some times when I have now not worn a mask where perhaps a year ago I would have.
I agree with that. I've sensed that myself. You know, I'm going to get to see my parents over Thanksgiving, so I'm being like a little bit more cautious right now, kind of in this kind of build up to actually seeing folks who are older adults in my life. But I, you know, sometimes have worn a mask less frequently when I know I haven't been around, won't be around any kind of higher risk populations in the foreseeable future. But yeah, still mask around the office, mostly because we don't want to get Trish sick. She's like our holdout on not having COVID around here, so we have to stay strong. I'll ask one or two specific ones. Like if you went to an outdoor concert like Taylor Swift, would you wear a mask?
If it's outdoors, probably not.
Okay, indoors, like Lizzo, would you mask?
You know, I did, I'll confess, I went to the Dave Matthews concert and I did not wear a mask. Now, I've had a non-COVID cold the following week after that, so I probably paid the price for that, but it was a judgment at the time. And so I'm doing my whole confessional here.
Yes. Okay. So a little more Dave Matthews than Lizzo. I don't know if I would have guessed that, but I probably could have. Last set of questions here in the last minute I've got with you. Thinking about the holidays, folks are wondering, should they take rapid tests before they go hang out with family? How much do you trust them? Is that a good kind of policy? What would you recommend?
Yeah, I think the rapid tests are much more available now. There's probably not as a lot of downside to doing them, especially if you know that you're going to be around individuals like grandparents or people who may have higher risk factors for more severe disease. You know, I'll be honest, you know, the characteristics of the tests, you know, again, if you're not having symptoms, they're not that great compared to if you have symptoms, I think they're more reliable. So I wouldn't say that I personally test every time before I may interact with someone, but I think, again, you have to think about who's going to be at that family gathering. And especially because grandparents are often there, you know, it's not an unreasonable thing to do testing, or you can do testing for a few days, kind of going up to that to increase the proportion of capturing something. But everyone has to kind of make that judgment. And I think the other piece is that you want to make sure that everyone who's at that gathering is comfortable, right? So is everyone who's there comfortable not being masked? Or there may be some individuals who feel like they will mask either, again, because they have underlying risk factors, maybe they're a little bit older, and that's okay too, right? And so I think that's the biggest piece here, is to be able to have grace for people to make decisions based on their own assessment of risk. And again, I feel like we're in that transition phase compared to, you know, a year ago, 2 years ago, is very clear cut. You know, now it's much more of that individual decision making, particularly outside of the work environment.
Cool. Thank you, Tim. With that, Trish, I'll hand it back to you.
Thank you, Anne. Thank you, Tim. And now, not surprisingly, we know Tim would prefer Dave Matthews to Lizzo. I'm going to end by saying thank you, as I always do. Thank you, special thank you to Kim for joining us and for all the work you're doing to take care of the patients and families at Seattle Children's Hospital. Thanks to all the panelists. Thanks for the questions that folks send in. And I just wanted to reflect for a minute that I was reflecting. I didn't hear Anne's well-being message today, but I had a guess of what she might say about the holidays. And I am working in the medical ICU at Montlake for this Thanksgiving. And the last time I did that was in 2019. And I was kind of sad about it, to be honest. It was a hard holiday for me to work. And I find myself feeling entirely different about it this year. And part of it is because I feel like one of the greatest lessons of the pandemic is that we're able to celebrate and make it work in a lot of different ways by being creative. And so creating community and being with each other, we make it work however we need to. And I thought about it and I was like, the nurses have done that in the medical ICU for all of my career. They have always made, and all the other people too, but really the nurses, have made Thanksgiving really Thanksgiving, or Christmas, Christmas, or Hanukkah, Hanukkah, or whatever it is that you're celebrating, really a holiday, because we care about each other and because we care about patients and families who are celebrating important days in a way that is not ideal, that they're in the hospital when they don't want to be in the hospital. And it's even harder on holidays. So I want to stop by saying a special thank you to everybody who's going to be working over this holiday and other holidays over the next several weeks, because it's because of you that patients and families can make it feel as good as they possibly can at a really challenging time. And it's because of you that people like me are like, it's okay to be working in the hospital over a holiday because I'm with the people who make it special. So thank you all, as always, for continuing to take care of our patients and our families and doing special duty as we move forward to take care of each other. Thanks, and we'll see you again soon. Bye.